Well, listen, welcome to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California for Monday, March 21st, 2016. This was the week, this was the day, in fact, in which Donald Trump bragged to AIPAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, that his daughter is going to give birth to a Jewish child. That's, you kind of can't play that card with every group you speak in front of, but he has. Listen, thank you for joining us here today in San Francisco. I'm John Zipper, your host for Week to Week and the Vice President of Media and Editorial for the Commonwealth Club. On today's program, we are going to talk about violence and other occurrences on the presidential campaign trail, the University of California's handling of sexual harassment cases, the president's Supreme Court pick, and of course, other political news. As always, I will note that the Commonwealth Club is a place of people with a wide variety of views, sometimes within the same person. So any views that are expressed up here are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Now let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the far end of the stage with Carla Marinucci. She's the genius behind the Politico California Playbook. And you can also catch her on Twitter at @CMarinucci. Next to her is Daniel Borenstein, columnist and editorial writer for the Contra Costa Times and Oakland Tribune, soon to be the East Bay Times. And he's on Twitter at @BorensteinDan. And next to me is Dr. James Taylor, director of African American Studies and professor of political science in the Department of Politics at University of San Francisco. And by the way, Dr. Taylor will be the moderator for our program on March 29th with writer Thomas Frank right here in San Francisco. So please ask questions. There should be some cards out there. If not, we'll be distributing some cards and pencils, and I will do my best to ask as many of those questions as possible. Now, on to our roundtable. Let's start where else with the Republicans. There's been a lot of hand-wringing and condemnation this week over some fighting associated with Donald Trump rallies. James, Trump denies responsibility for the violence. Others, including many within his own party, blame him for inciting it. So what's your take on this?
There's no plausible deniability, I think, for Donald Trump. We've seen again and again, Rachel Maddow and others have done a really excellent job of painstakingly showing the pattern of his comments that have been provocative, not just the earlier insults towards different people and segments of the society, but actually at the campaigns. This last act where we saw this ex-soldier or recent soldier, the African-American gentleman just go buck wild punching the gentleman with the red, white, and blue shirt, Donald Trump was speaking as he was attacking him. And he was saying, get him out of here, get him out of here. There's no plausible deniability. And it's stunning to me that he's even, what's mind-blowing is after we've seen the violence, the media is still asking about the violence. That they're still taking this man seriously after we've seen this. If this was Jesse Jackson,
that's right.
This entire, everyone in this room and everyone in this country would be fiercely offended. But Donald Trump gets a pass on his behavior.
Why?
I have a lot of answers to that. I think one, because we're just very familiar with him.
I am.
Donald Trump is, I grew up in New York. I remember the Central Park jogger event, and I remember Donald Trump made young men when I was younger scared to death because he came up with this phenomenon, and the media came up with Giuliani of wilding, and they claimed that young African Americans were going about committing this kind of uncontrolled violence, and it turned out to be untrue. In the last 6 or 7 years, the entire debacle was exposed, and Trump and Giuliani and the prosecutors in New York have all doubled down as if they did not create one of the great heinous crimes in American history akin to the Scottsboro Boys in 1935. That's what Donald Trump is party to, and people are still asking, where is his racism? I just heard him just now on the way in here telling Wolf Blitzer, I'm the least racist person you know. And I'm just thinking, you know, this is absurd at this point.
I think the media is complicit in this. I watch this every day. We watch it today. Trump gave about a 40-minute news conference there out in front of the old post office where he's changing that into a hotel. He really didn't get any questions, any hard questions on this, even though, you know, his manager there, Corey Lewandowski, is seen on video grabbing a protester by the collar. I mean, this just goes on and on, and he, no hard questions and a complete pass when it comes to allowing him just full access to the airwaves for unlimited amounts of time and whenever he has a press conference. I just don't get it.
So okay, Dan, it's up to you to defend Trump now.
But here's the real, here's the question. We know this is how he's going to behave. We know this is who he is. The question is, do the protests help or hurt his cause when they show up? You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm the only one who sort of, when I hear that there were big protests showing up in his rally, I just feel like you're playing right into his hands.
He wants it.
He wants it. Bring it on. And the best thing, maybe I'm wrong, but politically it seems to me, especially now, the best thing they could do is ignore him. I'm really not convinced that the protests don't do anything but play right into his hands.
Because his supporters...
His supporters eat
like
their
that.
Stuff up. They just totally eat it up.
I don't know. I think it's a good question. And Trump is using this. He's saying, you know, these Black Lives Matter protesters are trying to block access to my rallies and so forth. It's just ginning up the whole issue.
Yeah.
And, you know, you look forward and you go, is this what we're in for the next, until November? Yeah.
This is what we're in for until November.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, just.
Yes, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
These
well,
kind of
yeah.
angry, yeah. you know, the, this kind of violence, it's frightening. It's
now,
frightening.
I read an editorial today, and it suggested that a serious incident is predictable.
Yeah.
And you rest assured they already have the responses prepared for what, if A happens, how we will respond. And these sort of game models of what will happen. And I really do think Donald Trump has taken this country at the national level of politics in places that Rachel Maddow said recently, we've only seen at the local level.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen Huey Long, right, in Louisiana. We know Father Coughlin back in Indiana. I mean, Donald Trump is the most recent installment of this tradition. And I'm writing a book right now on People's Temple, Jim Jones and California Black Politics. And so that might be interesting to people here in San Francisco. And as much as Donald Trump and Jim Jones have nothing to do with each other facially, the more I try to understand Jim Jones and the psychology that was at work here, the more I see that Donald Trump is doing the same thing to this country. Through the power of suggestion, Donald Trump keeps telling you he's great. He's amazing. We're going to be amazing. The wall's going to be amazing. No one's looked at this man's finances. Mitt Romney knows that there's a problem there. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump probably isn't even a billionaire. And we won't even know. Because he's lied to us about everything. What has Donald Trump not lied to us about? And I think when you begin to realize that, this man has played, I'm teaching over at Berkeley, teaching a class on minstrel performance. And Donald Trump is performing a minstrel.
Minstrel specifically meaning what?
Meaning basically playing a role, a caricature. That has nothing to do with him directly, except his own psychological demons he might be trying to exercise. But he's certainly trying to appeal to some red meat emotional issues, wedge issues in our politics.
James, coming back to what you mm-hmm. said, though, about him gaming out
mm-hmm.
how to react.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't we really see that perfectly at Chicago, where he canceled it?
Yeah.
I mean, that no event, canceled event, has ever gotten so much
yeah.
coverage.
Yeah.
And has the politician ever turned an event, a canceled event,
yeah.
into such a positive
yeah.
spin
yeah.
as that?
Mm-hmm.
He had it perfectly gamed
yeah.
out.
Yeah. See, but I think Donald Trump's inexperience is going to show up. I'm one of the few people I've been consistently saying Donald Trump is not what he's being made out to be. Again, Donald Trump is leading. He is not won. Ted Cruz has a better pathway to the nomination than Bernie Sanders does with Hillary Clinton. Ted Cruz has won 8 states, I think 9 now, and caucuses. And in order to even be in the conversation with Trump, to be a part of the debate, to be a part of the floor fight that everyone's predicting, you had to win at least 8 states. And so Cruz is qualified. Kasich is not even qualified to get in, to be considered for nomination, and no one seems to have told him that. He's focusing on 1237. He should be focusing on 8. 8, you have to win 8 states first. Then you have to, and you, at a minimum, to qualify to be a part of the floor fight at the brokered convention. So please be clear. 8 first, and then you could talk about 1237.
Well, isn't he actually hoping for, you know, the talk of, last week we had Melissa Kane give a presentation on, they can change the rules right at the beginning of the thing. And you have a lot of these delegates who are pledged formally to vote for Trump, but if they pass a rule, which those delegates get to vote on, saying, you're freed,
But can't they go the other way and say we now have super delegates on the fly?
That's the whole thing. They can make any rule, and as long as they can get people to vote yes, you know, that's how the whole 8 state things came around, because they wanted to prevent Ron Paul from being, which was seems ridiculous, because Ron Paul was a threat to was not a threat to Mitt Romney.
Just think about what we were thinking 10 months ago about how this would play out. It's rare that we ever have a presidential primary that plays out exactly as we expect. But boy, this one, I don't think practically anyone got it right.
We were expecting a Clinton-Bush matchup.
Yeah.
Jeb Bush, and he went nowhere. And then on this stage, I had successive panels, none of you folks, so I'm not blaming you, who all said the Republican nominee is going to be Marco Rubio.
Right, that's right.
They were sure
of it. One of those.
Liberal and conservative panelists, they were all saying that.
Yeah. I still thought last week that despite everything else, Marco Rubio would stay in for no other reason than to continue to split the vote to ensure it going to the floor. And I was really surprised.
Yeah, well, he's thinking more about his own career in 2020.
He's thinking more of his career. Yeah. Yeah. And I thought sure that establishment Republicans would try and make sure he stayed in.
Yeah.
I think
one of the things that's been interesting to me is just how the rest of the world too is viewing what we're seeing. I just got back from Berlin, where I did a symposium that the government sponsored on the American election, and I was amazed that on a Friday night in Berlin we had 500 people came out. They are terrified about watching Donald Trump, and their questions to us are, What is his worldview? What's his global? What are his policies? What can we expect in terms of his international outlook?
What did you tell him, Carla?
It's like, you got me. And of course they're watching in Germany, where there's a rise of an anti-immigrant party, Alternatives for Germany party, which just won 2 out of 3 local elections there. A real message to Angela Merkel. I mean, so the Europe is watching this election, and their question is, how is it that 8 years after you all elected Barack Obama, and this was a transformation, that you've got this guy? I mean,
but we've been schizophrenic like that before. I think Rick Perlstein's work, anyone familiar with Nixon Land? He documents the way we had these pendulous swings between the landslide of 64 and then 66 with Nixon, you know, the midterm election that goes back the other way, and then 68 gives us Nixon. You can look at Bush. You see Jimmy Carter. Let me start with Jimmy Carter. You start with Jimmy Carter, and what was before Jimmy Carter was Richard Nixon and his scandals, right? Mm-hmm. And then you end up with the Baptist preacher as a consequence.
Right. Right.
Then you fast forward to George Bush, who comes right after Bill Clinton, who had these moral scandals around Monica Lewinsky and all of the stuff we know about. And then what do we get? The religious evangelical as a kind of balance. So it would not be unprecedented in our recent politics for us to go from the first black president to someone who had a problem, got tongue twisted, renouncing the KKK. That his father belonged to in the 1930s.
Right. But remember, the Europeans are looking at this and saying, oh, wait a minute, we've seen this movie before. Berlusconi, a rich guy, you know, I can make deals. I know how to do this. Don't worry. You know, I'm sorry. Make America Great Again is not too far from what Hitler, Make Germany Great Again. I mean, they are watching this in Europe with chills, and I couldn't believe the number of people who came out to ask. I mean, really, is this the road America is going down? And you don't know.
See, I have faith, and I shared this with them in the back room, and they didn't seem to be impressed with it. So I'll see if you guys like it even better. But I've been looking just sort of off the cuff at how many people voted in 2008, how many people voted in 2012 in the primaries only, in the Republican primaries, And I think it was 18 million and 17 million respectively. And Obama won with 131 in 08 and 129 million in 12. So look at the mathematical differences between that 18 and that 17 million and the 131 and the 129. Ultimately, that includes Republicans who also come out eventually for the general election. So what I'm saying is there's about 111, 110, 120 million more Americans who are going to have the final say that have had nothing to say so far. And there's I assume there's a wisdom in 129 million Americans going in a very different route than the original 18 million did.
Okay, James. So let me
disagree.
Put a question. Yeah. Do you remember Obama won in 2008? And do you remember how much punditry there was that the electoral map in the United States has changed forever? That the Democrats, you know, will own this nation going forward.
Texas is going blue.
Texas is going blue, right, yeah. And, I mean, how many times have we watched?
Yeah.
About how angry white men are going to be the center of the universe.
Boy, I feel like it's back to the future.
That was 1996, and 92 was the year of the angry woman.
Mm. Yeah. So now it's angry white men. That's right.
Someone from the audience. Sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Someone in the audience asks: is there any chance that Trump, if elected, would be moderated by talented advisors and the realities of congressional politics?
There's been some suggestion that you're going to see Trump already start to walk back, you know, some of these positions, like the wall with Mexico. Well, maybe we don't have to build it all at once. Maybe we'll do this in installments.
Maybe they will take one.
Yeah. Or, you know, the Muslim ban on Muslims. Well, he's already started walking. I mean, you will see him because where's his political center anyway, right?
He's talking universal health care.
I mean,
and being neutral with Israel, which is really, you know, Hillary came out swinging at AIPAC today because of his neutral position. And if you're on the left, you're like, well, I hate Donald Trump, but that sure sounds good. You know, universal health care. I hate Donald Trump. He's the worst. He's Hitler. But Hitler's offering universal health care, you know. So there are these things that Trump, because he has no moral core and no core, I guess, being a New Yorker, again, I'm trying to figure out. No, I'm a New Yorker. When I don't mean New Yorkers don't have a moral core. I don't want to become Ted Cruz. But Donald Trump obviously is making appeal into the Deep South. And I'm asking someone, again, I'm not inclined to automatically assume race first. But I'm trying to figure out what is the connection between Donald Trump as a New Yorker, brash and everything that is despised by Southerners, and the deep Southern culture of New York and Northeasterners in general.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump is not, Mitt Romney, Michael Dukakis, all of the Massachusetts people that have run for president, John Kerry, have been rejected. It was a non-starter when they made an appeal to the South. How is Donald Trump winning down there?
Well, do you think?
Well,
so
for
he,
me,
he is addressing then those concerns of the.
Well, I think these people are really in distress economically. Yeah. They've been in distress for over 40 years. They've been in distress. Mm-hmm. Just because Donald Trump is their tribune doesn't mean that he's not akin to a broken clock being right twice a day.
He's not in a. He doesn't convey the Ivy League Northeasterner, you will.
No.
Donald Trump is a. Is a unique character, mm-hmm. for better or for worse, and he's an entertainer, and that's part of it. You know, I mean, how do most people know about Donald Trump? They saw him on television. Mm-hmm.
How many of you have ever seen an episode of
Apprentice,
Celebrity Apprentice, or whatever?
Celebrity Apprentice.
You're fired.
Someone in the audience asked. Does the Democratic Party also bear a responsibility for the rise of Trump in that they have not addressed those needs of those?
I think in fairness, and I'll try to be quick, that if you go back to the Reagan Democrats, Reagan's appeal, Nixon's appeal, I mean, the unfortunate thing, and LBJ made this clear, is all you have to do is throw these people in a crumb that they're better than the lowest person of color, and they'll be satisfied with their low position. And they'll let you rob them, he says, put their hands in their pockets as long as you tell the poorest white man he's better than anything else out there. And I think that has always worked to the detriment of the working class white element in this country. What's the matter with Kansas, right? We look at that next week. What's the matter with Oklahoma that used to be the bastion of socialism in America?
But let's look.
Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, populism, progressivism, that was it. Not mm-hmm. New York and Chicago. It was Oklahoma was the reddest state in America mm-hmm. for different reasons. And because of the 60s, the cultural impacts, the disentanglement around cultural feeling about belonging in America for many of these people began to feel unfamiliar. And we didn't nurture it in any way. We just assumed they would take care of it. Jerry Springer showed us that they were seriously, he took them seriously. And I don't think we should laugh about that. Jerry Springer respects them and took them seriously because he understands it's easy to be elitist and look down on people in their predicament. These people are, when you look at income, you look at jobs, the things that impacted minorities disproportionately are now impacting them powerfully. And I think that's James.
Let's look at sort of the politics, and you know, because on the one hand, I agree with you. On the other hand, there is sort of this political reality. It's easy to blame the Democrats, mm-hmm. but on the other hand, the Democrats are a collage mm-hmm. even themselves. And if you think about politically, what, 2008, mm-hmm. 2009, Obama comes into office. Mm-hmm. He's got both houses, and he can barely put together health care, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Why? Because his own party is splintered. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is, Democrats, that included Southern Democrats mm-hmm. still. Mm-hmm. And the politics of it are still limiting. Mm-hmm. And so it's easy to say the Democrats dropped the ball, but the reality is for the last 6 years, they haven't had any control, mm-hmm. right?
I think you're seeing now on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton has now turned and pivoted toward Donald Trump. You saw that with the APEC speech yeah. that she did today. She was very tough on him, saying, you know, this guy wants to negotiate everything. Some things are not negotiable. We've got to have a leader up there who we know has some kind of core principles. And I think this is where the trauma comes in on the Democratic side now, because there is a lot of pressure, or starting to be a lot of pressure, on Bernie Sanders to now turn, stop criticizing Hillary Clinton so much, and to start putting that contrast with Donald Trump. Because right now they've been focusing on each other. Yeah. Sanders at this point, look, he raised $12 million more than she did in the last month. But she now has $30 million she's sitting on. He's got a lot less. Yeah. And the fact is that even Senator Boxer said today, look, you know, the writing is on the wall for Bernie Sanders. And that's creating, it's kind of interesting to watch on the Democratic side on Twitter. There's a lot of anger among Sanders followers saying, wait a minute, yeah. not so fast. Yeah. We're not ready to go with Hillary yeah. Clinton yet.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Carla. Bernie's going to do much better coming west. The African-American mm-hmm. vote and the minority vote is not significant in the West. And I said on KQED a couple of weeks ago that outside of the South, blacks will be different and will be less forgiving of the Clintons for their impact on African-American life through war and drugs policies and welfare reform policies mm-hmm. than blacks outside the South, like in Chicago or, you know, New York. They're not going to be forgiving. There's no automatic default Protestant orientation to forgive that you saw, for example, when there was a shooting in Charleston. There was before the day ended, that family said, we forgive the shooter. That would not happen in Chicago or New York. There's a whole different priming. There's a whole different priming through the migration process that shows a very differentiated African-American electorate. And blacks in the Midwest are very different than blacks in the South or in the Northeast. And anyone thinking that they are going to all fall in line don't understand the African-American voting the electorate. They're very sophisticated. You have to remember, they first belonged to Hillary before they left her for Obama. They're going back to Hillary. It took only a black person, a black candidate of exceptional ability like Barack Obama, to even pull the African-American loyal votes away from the Clinton establishment. Mm-hmm. And now that he's off the scene, they're going right back to the default. And Bernie Sanders is up against that. And the millennials obviously are showing signs of supporting her a little bit, but also supporting him a little bit amongst African-Americans. But it seems to me that, Bernie's up against an uphill battle, but he can win the West. And if he wins these Western primaries, at the very least, it changes the conversation for Hillary going forward. It's not inevitable at this point, but again,
but he's under pressure. He's more and more under pressure.
But these are all her friends. Right. These are, I mean, I looked yeah. at, there were like, I think Claire McCaskill, Barbara Boxer, I think four other women, friends of hers that were colleagues and senators are like, yo, Bernie, get out. Don't mess this up, you know, mm-hmm. by going too hard in on Hillary. Yeah. I think especially when he began to attach Rahm Emanuel to Hillary Clinton in Chicago, that's when they said, okay, this can get scary because if he continues this on,
yeah.
this can backfire on her.
I mean, taking that into account, she still won Illinois, which is actually that Super Tuesday, the mini Super Tuesday state that I thought he, if he was going to steal one, you know, a surprise mm-hmm. one like he did with
well,
Michigan,
that's also the
that
one
it would
came,
be.
It came down to the end.
Yeah.
Closer than any of the others.
It was close.
Except for Missouri.
She yeah. did win it. Yeah, Missouri was the one that, you know, it's. Yeah.
But Missouri,
she
but
won
if
it
the
by
big
it.
Ones. Yeah.
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 But that said, does he, I mean, what are his actual chances going forward? And just for the sake of argument, assume he's not going to be the nominee. What does he want to do? What can he do?
Yeah, I think
you know, is he making a VP play or is he, I mean, he's really, he genuinely cares about these issues because
well,
he want to write this.
And now, John, we're going to see, I mean, look, Bernie Sanders is here in California tomorrow in San Diego giving a big rally. Finally, it's come to California. Yay. I mean, this is like, when was the last time we actually saw a presidential rally here in California? Hillary Clinton is here in the Bay Area this week. She's going to be fundraising here in Atherton and in Los Angeles again. Maybe we'll get to see a rally with her also. But the fact is that now it comes to California, and you're going to see, you're already seeing on the Republican side too, there's politics are going on in the Cruz campaign, in Trump campaign, you know, I mean, and Kasich, who has Schwarzenegger with him, and Steve Poizner, somebody
that
who...
That should put him over
right.
the top.
Yeah. Well, that should put him over the top. But the fact is that California is going to matter this time around, and particularly on the Republican side, it's going to be fascinating to watch because you can see some of these Republicans freaking out at the possibility of what is this going to do to the down some of yeah. the down-ballot races.
And it's already in trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, the Republicans have had a 30 seats, you know, safe distance between them and the Democrats, and now at least half those seats are in play, and they expect all 30 to be in play by November, and they expect that the Republicans are on the verge of losing control of everything, except the state houses. And Donald Trump has done for the Democrats what they could not have done for about three election cycles going forward. No, really, that's really what happened. He has reduced the time that it would take Democrats to incrementally get back those 30 seats or compete for them. And in one or two election cycles, he's put it in play.
I want to talk to you about this the day after Election Day in November mm-hmm. and see how close that yeah. turns out.
The question
out.
Is, though, will he fire up? Enough of his voters. As we know, the Republican turnout in some of these states is way higher than it on the Democratic yeah. side. There's been some suggestion that here in California, he may turn out enough people to even affect the Senate contest, get a Republican into that top two primary. Mm-hmm. I'm not clear whether that's going to happen or not, because I think that will be offset by the Latino yeah. vote here in California. I've already heard some Latino voters tell me, look, I remember having that button that said deport Pete Wilson back when I was a yeah. kid. Now my daughter has the button that says, you yeah. know, dump Trump.
Well, there are two effects, though.
Yeah.
There's the effect in June, in California, if you will. And in June, this has the effect of really reshaping some districts in terms of top two that were districts where you might have assumed it was going to be two Democrats going to November mm-hmm, or something mm-hmm. like that. And so there are, and the Senate race perhaps being the biggest one. But then there's a whole different calculus of what happens then come November, and there's a whole different calculus of what happens come November nationwide, right?
Right.
I'm not convinced. I'll be very surprised if the Democrats manage to take back the House. Mm. I'll be shocked. Mm-hmm. Okay, that would take it would take a real implosion of Donald Trump
yeah. because we're seeing it.
But
we're watching it.
But remember, the House seats The House seats are district by district.
Right.
And so and they're so gerrymandered anyhow. Are there really enough competitive seats where that makes a difference?
There are about 15 that are, and then there are another 15 that they are assuming if Trump goes forward, he could put those in play. But certainly right now, the Democrats are not complaining about Donald Trump.
Yeah.
He's doing a good
deal
of
harm. But would you agree that it's a long shot that they take back the House?
It's a long shot. I agree with that. But, I would agree with that. But I do think
the Senate looks better.
The Senate looks better. And I think
But the Senate looked better from the get-go, right?
Now, this really shows what type of an election year this is. I got a question from someone who is talking about how, you know, you talk about the media is talking too much about Trump, and that's all you're talking about. We actually shifted to talk about the Democrats, and we still ended up talking about Donald Trump. So we're addicts. We know we have a problem, and we are working through this. Someone asked, how would Ted Cruz do against Hillary Clinton compared to how Trump would do against her? Would that change any of these dynamics about, for example, the down ticket harm that some Republicans are worried about? Keeping in mind that Ted Cruz is despised by every other Republican in the Senate. I mean, I'm not even exaggerating.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think Ted Cruz would be even more of a disaster for the Republicans.
Because he really believes what he believes.
Yeah.
He's a true believer, and I think Robert Rice has tried to make that clear.
Yeah.
But Trump may not be serious.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. I will say, I know Ted Cruz here in California has a ground game going, has an organization going. So it is going to be interesting to watch. Trump has no organization, really.
No.
And remember that the general election requires a lot of ground game and a lot of organization, very expensive. And is he willing to put up that money? Who's going to put up that money?
If you just look at Trump, just go prior, you know, Republican 2016 Republican primary campaign, and just look at the money aspect. You'll be shocked that Trump doesn't have a lot of money, that he has about $1 million in his account. That he loaned, I think, $27 or $28 million to the campaign. But my point is, there are people like Carson. What's his name? Carson.
Ben Carson.
I can't believe I forgot his name already. Ben Carson. Ben Carson. Ben Carson has more money on file right now than Donald Trump's campaign does. You know, Donald Trump.
But he doesn't need the money.
Because the national media is running the campaign for him.
The free media is.
He doesn't have to pay for the TV time. Right.
He gets it.
Right. No, we agree. I mean, the TV time, he's being given a pass on. And it's unfair to these other candidates who are having to put out millions and millions of dollars. Even Jeb Bush, I mean, I think he put out about $130 million. And he got a little bit more than me.
Well, I was speaking with a couple of our audience members before the program about the Koch brothers and their network have been talking about raising nearly $1 billion to try to influence this campaign in the favor of Republicans, and they might see a blowout on the presidential level. They might see a loss of the Senate. It does at least say there are limits to the Citizens United world, isn't there?
Yeah. We have yet to see, and I think the other interesting aspect of it is there going to be some kind of third party?
Talk about that.
I heard Rick Perry being interviewed today and just refusing to be pinned down as to whether he could possibly be drafted at the convention.
Rick Perry?
Fully possible.
Rick
he doesn't
Perry.
Know.
I mean, there's names being thrown around. Condoleezza Rice. The Republicans are.
Carla,
there's like an emergency freakout going
on. It's not so much being drafted at the convention, though. But let's talk about this third party or third candidate, because it's still the same party, if you will. Right? Scenario is kind of disturbing how this would play out. This notion that, if you could just grab a couple of big states, then you throw it to the House. I mean, this is
And explain what that actually means. When you're throwing it to the House, you're talking about
the Electoral College?
Yes.
Yeah.
The election. So who is voting then on the next president
of
the United States?
Well, as I understand it, you correct me if I'm wrong, right? 12th Amendment, right? You get one vote per state. And, you know, this is a really sort of different, and it's amongst the top four, is it, right, mm-hmm. that you get to pick?
Yeah.
And so this, if somebody could get in and grab one or two key states such that nobody gets a majority of the Electoral College. Remember, Clinton won mm-hmm. With a plurality mm-hmm. of the popular vote, but a majority of the Electoral College. Then it goes into the House. So what you really need is a Ross Perot who could actually win a state, a big state, right? And or two, and have a close race between the rest. Now, of course, the question, you know, I've been thinking this.
I mean, what the dilemma here, I think, for Republicans, some of these principled Republicans, and I Luis Alvarado, a Latino strategist, I was on this panel with him in Berlin, said, he's a Republican strategist, said, I will not, there is no way, I cannot support Donald Trump. There are Republicans out there who say, based on his philosophies and what he's already espoused, there is no way I'm going to support him. And yet you see the rest of these candidates have said he's a fraud, he's a joke, but yeah, we'll support if he's the nominee,
we'll support him. Yeah.
How does the party come out ahead there?
Party, as a political scientist, party unity is probably the best predictor of electoral victory every 4 years in the national elections. Party unity, however you define that, is probably the best, sort of signal as to which party will win. And I guess if you sort of do a survey of going back to 64, look at which parties were the most divided in their primary processes and look at the outcome. I'm not saying this is a law or a rule, but a tendency and a pattern. And right now, I've been sort of, you know, as a political scientist, off the cuff, saying the Republicans are in for a landslide of trouble in November, because it doesn't require a lot of political education to figure this out. It's pretty clear that one party is in turmoil. It's pretty clear that another party has two plausible alternatives from the old school DNC and the new school DLC possibilities. That's the Democrats' fight is ideological within themselves. The Republicans, you've got about four or five different strains of orientations. And how to reconcile those in Donald Trump? No, I mean, I'm being very serious. He thinks he can mend this. I don't know if he, I don't, I'm not, I'm saying I don't know. I don't know who they have in their ranks equivalent to a Barack Obama. And this is what I'm suggesting to you. I'm saying that Barack Obama is the X factor for the Democrats. Like Mariano Rivera, as an old Yankee fan, like Mariano Rivera was for the Yankees reliably. I think Barack Obama comes in the ninth inning against Donald Trump and with Bill Clinton, and the two of them just work Trump, and both of their egos are as big as Trump's, and Obama still has the office that is bigger than Trump. And they will deliver in a way that that I think will... The Republicans just don't have an equivalent. If the Republicans had an equivalent to Barack Obama in terms of stature and status and respect in the leadership of the party, we wouldn't have Donald Trump this point.
We would have seen that.
He's personally proof that they have no one that can stop him. The Democrats have Barack Obama, and we've seen him handle Trump at the media party where he clowned him for about an hour and a half and gave him a new name practically. And Obama won that night. And I do think with Obama and Bill Clinton on the scene, if Bill is healthy and energetic, Trump is in, the Republicans are in real serious trouble.
I'm going to leap at that chance to talk about Democrats again. We're going to talk about very briefly, because we've got other stuff to talk about too, vice presidential picks. And someone in the audience was kind enough to share with us the Irish betting odds on Democratic presidential candidates.
That's good.
So, Julian Castro, mm-hmm. 3-1.
Yeah.
Tim Kaine, 3-1. Elizabeth Warren, 7-1. Oh, Tom Perez, 7-1. So,
No Deval Patricks?
No. Not on this list, at least. The Irish don't like them, I guess. Okay, well, let's actually move on.
Meanwhile, who would be Trump's vice presidential?
Well, he talked about Cruz. They mentioned it on the way here. Wolf Blitzer asked Cruz, would he be willing? And Cruz was angry. He said, no way. But Donald Trump said, you never know. This is politics. Anything can happen.
Donald Trump is not going to have, he's going to say, I can do both jobs.
No, he actually mentioned today that he was thinking about opening up a hotel in Havana already.
Wow.
This is a topic that cannot in any way come back to refer to Donald Trump, and that is the University of California sex harassment cases. The UC has been under the microscope for its treatment of sexual harassment accusations. Accusations, against faculty and staff. Carlo, what's going on? What are we seeing?
Well, isn't it ironic that the motto of the University of California is fiat lux, let there be light, but there's been nothing but darkness and obfuscation, I think, on this whole issue. The headlines for the University of California this month have just been not good at all on a couple of different levels. One was the dean of the Berkeley Law School. Sujit Chaudhry, who resigned, but remains a member of the faculty after being accused of sexual harassment. This is the second prominent faculty member accused in the last year. There's been a number of stories about how the university has been all over the board in terms of the way they've handled the cases of some of this, these prominent.
Yeah. I teach there right now.
Sexual harassment.
I'm teaching there right now. And there's one young man who's been accused. And throughout the campus, his pictures are everywhere. And with it was a statement against the university for taking determined action against this individual. And his pictures are everywhere around the campus with, you know, the statement that the university has failed. And this young man still walks around the campus. They identify a specific young woman that he allegedly targeted and continues to be around campus where she is. And they haven't. So I don't have tenure over there, so they can do what they want with me. But I do have tenure at USF, so they can't do anything with me.
Well, who's to blame? I mean, does UC President Janet Napolitano, does she have
actually,
a grasp of this?
Actually, Napolitano has been the one sort of voice of sanity to a certain extent in all of this, in that she has said, this has got to stop. If there's a problem, it lies with Dirks and his administration and the administration you see. They've totally botched this from start to finish.
Yeah, and it just seems like it's really academic stars are given a pass on this. We've seen this before. And this wasn't the only sort of headline, UC headline this month. We had the UC Davis chancellor who had apologized for her moonlighting activities, and I mean, this was amazing because, you know, she not only earns $424,000 a year as a chancellor, but then she's accepting a $70,000 a year position with DeVry Education, which, you know, being investigated by the feds, and as well getting all kinds of stock options and other things from textbook manufacturers. In this case, Napolitano kind of gave her a pass and said, well, you know, she's done a lot of other good things.
This was disappointing.
You know, a lot of legislators are like, excuse me, but when was she exactly devoting time to UC Davis when she was getting all this other, this kind of moonlighting would never be acceptable in the private sector, but somehow she got a pass on that. So I think, the legislators looking at this and there's a lot of scrutiny, I think, on UC right now. And I think Napolitano's getting...
Well, she's saying, okay, this enough of this. Is she changing the rules, or is she saying adhere to the rules
she's
that we
trying,
have?
Napolitano is trying to force the campuses to enforce the rules they should have been doing, and she has stepped in weekend before last and really lowered the boom. Of course, the very next day, Monday, we find out that the assistant coach for the basketball team has a sexual harassment, is being fired for sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. And you read the report, and it's very disturbing. And what's more disturbing is then the athletic department turns around, because there's the second issue, which is, did Coach Martin know about this and fail to report it in a timely manner. And that's a little bit of a he said, she said between the victim and him as to what she actually told him early on. But there's another investigation into this. And of course, the athletic department's reaction is, we're going to have this investigation and we're confident it will exonerate Coach Martin. And it's like, wait a minute. Isn't this a little bit, doesn't this sort of undermine the whole purpose of having an investigation if you're going to declare the victor, so to speak, going into it? It was very disappointing. Yeah. The day after, or the Monday after, Napolitano had said, we're going to clean this up, after the law school dean fiasco.
Yeah, and he remains a member of the faculty.
And he remains a member. So, we have this reaction on the other front.
See, this is why I think, to bring it back to elections, I think, like, no, I don't mean it in any negative way. In 2008, in
what does Donald Trump have to do?
He will be the best chancellor.
Right. In 2008 and 2012, the African American vote outperformed every other group in the country twice, and no one expected it.
In percentage of
In terms of the number of people who could vote that actually did, their percentage, blacks outperformed everybody nationally twice, for the first time in American history. Nate Silver detected it in 12. Everybody else seems to have missed it for the most part. Mm-hmm. But what most people don't realize is underneath was the resentment around the voter ID laws in places like Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, North Carolina. And, for someone like me, my mother's 90 years old and was born in 1925 and escaped the South to get away. And then to imagine that before she leaves this earth, she will be rendered invisible again was just unacceptable. And I think what most Americans and pollsters did not detect was the black resentment for these voter IDs in 2008, 2012. And I'm using that as an analogy to say, without trying to be condescending towards women, these issues that you talk about, I think women are just sitting back waiting for their turn to vote. I'm not talking about these primaries where you have the most committed, but I think the independents and the neutrals, mm-hmm. I think when this vote comes out in November, women are going to have the final say, as they did in 96. The 96 election was called the Corvair Mom election. They thought it was going to be Volvo Moms, but it was lower white class, mm-hmm. working class women, Corvair Moms, who are still in play right now. And I really do think that, this is all in play right now. So going forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to our next topic then. And that is, again, nothing that rhymes with Trump. It's the Supreme Court. Of course, we all know Antonin Scalia passed away. The Republican senators came out and said, no way, no how, we're not going to even meet anyone you put forward. President Obama puts forward Merrick Garland. And they're still saying no way, no how. There are some cracks there. Did Obama call their bluff? Are they calling his bluff? Are they just putting this guy through the meat grinder? Because he is, by all things that I've read, a very nice and very accomplished and very smart guy who is probably still going to be a non-Supreme Court judge in January.
It's going to be interesting to see how much heat the Republicans will take. The polls are showing 2/3 of Americans believe that he should be given some kind of a hearing here. Just about everyone agrees he's one of the most qualified men to be put up for this position in maybe a generation. And people like Orrin Hatch and so forth have spoken so highly of him. The question is, McConnell has said, no way, I'm not even going to meet with you. I think we have yet to see how this is going to play out.
Well, the question is, does it matter in the electoral framework? And
meaning, do people vote on this?
Do people vote on this? And I think the answer is that the two extremes do vote on this, mm-hmm. the two sides. But I'm not sure whether it's going to matter to the swing voters. Enough, McConnell's probably doing a calculation that he needs to hang on to his base more than that the swing voters aren't going to care that much. Whether he's right or wrong remains to be seen, but the polls say, most people want a vote, but are they going to vote their presidential ticket
based on that?
Based on that.
Yeah.
And I'm not convinced they're going to.
So if that's the case, yeah. Is this a good choice, a good pick, or could he have picked anyone? I mean, you might remember the...
No, it's a good pick.
It is.
It's a good pick.
Yeah.
Because if he picks a... If he doesn't pick a centrist jurist, then that becomes the issue. He's neutral. Any hope of using this for as a political wedge, if you will, to get it through, or at least to bolster, to change turnout in November, is undermined if he picks another Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
So he took the opposite. Okay. You're all familiar with The Onion. They had a headline that Obama compiles shortlist of gay, transsexual, abortion doctors to replace Scalia. Like everything that would annoy the Republican senators.
It would be interesting to watch if Hillary Clinton is elected, whether there'll be some kind of a lame duck.
McConnell already says that if Obama nominates someone now and that person's a holdover into if Hillary or the Democrat wins, he said he still will not hear that person that Obama nominated. I keep saying, like Obama recently, I have faith in the American people. I have to believe the American people, there's a collective wisdom in the American people that will rise to the occasion to deal with Trump and these other issues. If not, then I guess that tells us where we are.
Someone asks, so if Hillary becomes president and nominates Barack Obama for the Supreme Court, is that at all in the realm of possibility or just a delicious Democratic dream?
It would be, I won't say that. I was going to say something about Clarence Thomas, but I won't. That way I can live to fight another day.
Do you think he would take it?
I don't think so, but
no?
I think there's an intellectual interest.
Yeah, I mean, it's that or Bill Clinton.
If he had never become president, I think it'd be more plausible, obviously, if he was a senator, who, because of his legal background, with the University of Chicago and Harvard.
Constitutional law, yeah.
Yeah, but in terms of doing this now, I think William Howard Taft is the only other president who went from the presidency to the office. So that would be interesting. And it might lead to a more... I don't know how to say this properly, but to a more democratic milieu, in the sense that it's not like we hold Obama up in this iconic place where he can only, he can never reduce himself to the Supreme Court. And if that doesn't have a sort of democratic effect in terms of it just sort of saying, yeah, I served in that capacity and I served the people there, mm-hmm. and now I'm being given this calling and I'm serving the people here in this capacity. That, I think, is would be ideal, but it would sort of signal a shift in our politics for us to take seriously an ex-president as a Supreme Court justice, because I don't know if we're mature enough, because we don't have a recent enough reference where this was reasonable.
Yeah, Taft in the Supreme Court, was it one of the Adamses who, after being president, served in the House of Representatives?
Yeah.
You know, something, again, you'd see a lot in Europe, where a former prime minister or chancellor continues to serve.
No, the team of rivals, right? All of these men work together that will form rivals. For the betterment of the country.
Yeah.
There's a concept.
And if you keep talking about Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan and having a glass of scotch and coming up with these sort of Irish solutions to the American problems, those were the good old days. But I think the literature, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but Morris Fiorina over at Stanford, Bill Bishop, who's a journalist, I think, down in Texas, he's written a book called The Big Sort. Fiorina's book is called Cultural Wars with a Question Mark.
That's
and they talk about political polarization and how the red and blue phenomena flattens out in so many different ways in terms of ethnicity and culture and race, yes, but also ideology. The liberals on this side don't talk to the conservatives on that side.
Yeah.
And Bishop says it effectively creates a echo chamber effect. That you only reiterate your point of view on this side of the room, and you only reiterate your point of view on this side of the room. All of you are Americans. If Mujahideen show up, all 50,000 of them across the seas, trust me, all your problems with the liberals and the Democrats and the conservatives will vanish overnight. And so I think, this is the challenge, is how do we get past our polarizations? But it's so deeply embedded that the people we're talking about are all just players. They're all actors on a stage. This goes back to 64.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is why we have a social hour before Week to Week. You all get to meet the one Republican who's from San Francisco.
Maybe that's what we should
have
do.
Have a drink with them.
Create a 501c3 for making everybody get along. You're helping everybody get along.
There you go.
Well, let's talk about something local, but I think it's indicative of a challenge that, I mean, actually, it echoes of this in Washington, D.C. recently. BART. San Francisco Metro, and BART is having serious troubles. And I kind of have the question of, is this a matter of mismanagement, lack of funding from the people? The Contra Costa Times editorial yesterday, was it?
It was, it'll appear in tomorrow's paper. It went online Friday, yes.
Very good. Yeah. Quote, it's true that there's not enough money for all of BART's capital needs, but that's due in large part to poor financial planning and overly generous labor compensation. BART officials should fix that before asking voters to raise taxes, unquote. Dan?
Well, we've sort of taken a consistent position through all of this that's been going on for 6 years. 6 or 7 years on our editorial page, which is, look, you got to look at how your labor costs compare to the same types of positions in other places, and yes, adjusted for cost of living, but you got to look at total compensation and see how you compare to these jobs. And back in 2009, I believe it was, when they did their last labor negotiations before, they actually did this. BART did this, and it showed that, you know, BART workers were at the very, very top in the nation, total compensation.
But they're also in one of the most expensive areas.
No. Inflation adjusted.
Even adjusted
cost of living adjusted. Okay. And then, fast forward, and they do the negotiations in 2013, and there is no salary survey. They basically, and we know what happened during those negotiations. We came down to, they were close to a standoff, and then suddenly they send their negotiator out of town. They have their staff suddenly negotiating it, and they cut this deal that gives away, that basically doubles their offer overnight, of the increase,
And meanwhile, 400,000 people are put out when BART goes
right.
on strike.
Yeah.
So really, don't get me started on this whole issue of BART.
But so the basic line of this is, you've got this labor cost problem. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, over all these years, and you go back four decades with BART, they have never, most transit systems and responsible systems, you start realizing that your capital is going to wear away. So you start setting aside money for it.
So what is
BART has never done that.
What is it about BART? You know, they were tweeting this week, oh, gee, we've reached the end of our life. We never expected that, you know, this many people be riding. Hello. I mean,
what
New York City subway.
Well,
yeah.
Right.
I mean, you can go to any major metropolitan, you know, Mexico City, Berlin, wherever. These systems are decades old and managed to run perfectly fine. And here you can't even get, something to hang on to when you're in the middle of the... I mean, what is it with BART?
How many of you took BART here tonight from the East Bay?
Wow.
That's quite a few.
You actually made it here, right?
Yeah. The other half of you are still stuck waiting for the shuttle.
Come on! The system has just been so poorly run for so long in terms of the way you compare this to any major system around the world. You know, go to Istanbul, whatever. The systems are so much better. Here you can't even get an announcement of what station you're at. I mean, how is it that, Dan, this system has been so poorly run for so long? Is it because BART is one of, only three transit districts in the country that has an elected board?
It's highly politicized. It's politicized in a way that most transit boards aren't in such a visually obvious way. And what that means is that frankly, there's one special interest group that controls most of the board members. And yes, the answer in part is that yes, it is problematic. The other problem is, of course, we have these competing transit systems around the Bay Area. We have one of the most fractured transit systems.
So isn't it time for somebody to say, look, we need to take a regional approach to this whole thing?
Yes.
Only Donald Trump can make something that big happen.
Can negotiate this. But
how politically do you do that? In other words, is the answer, there's a danger of if we create an elected regional board like that, will we have the same? Will we have
the same problems? Only
the same problems, only bigger. You know, I mean, for all the problems some of these little transit agencies have, at least they're sort of more answerable to their local communities. Mm-hmm. It's a real conundrum because we really have a mess.
Okay,
and we haven't been setting. You know, with BART, the big thing is we haven't been properly setting aside money. So now what we're going to have, and that goes to the editorial, so what we're going to have come November is that BART wants a big wad of cash from property owners in terms of another property tax increase. And they promptly came out, you know, some of the people at BART, including this tweeter who put out this tweet you were mentioning. You know, I mean, the message here is that we, you know, this is what's going to happen in the future if you don't give us more money. And our editorial point there was, time out. In this case, they don't even know what caused this. And they've already determined that it's the aging system. Yes, they need money for capital.
Mm-hmm.
But they also have money for capital. So let's keep this in perspective here a little bit.
Okay. Briefly, before we get to the news quiz, our president is overseas, but like very close by. He's in Cuba. What have you thought about? So did you see his press conference? Did anyone see the press conference he had with Raul Castro?
Yeah. This is going to be a famous gesture from now on.
Yeah,
it's going to be called the Obama.
Castro tried to.
People at nightclubs are going to see people they don't like. They're just going to do like this across the club. Or see somebody at an office. Meaning I'm not really feeling you.
Yes. Yeah. Well, what do you think about President Obama forcing Castro for the first time ever to take some questions from press?
Amazing.
And he did not want to. Castro did not want to. If you get a chance to watch the video clip of it, I mean, it'd be like, you know, getting a six-year-old to eat liver or something.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I went to Cuba 35 years ago, and I remember we at that time. I mean, I watched it today, and it's just amazing because at that time, Cubans were afraid, absolutely afraid, to talk to anybody. They immediately started speaking to you in Russian because they assumed that you were Russian. You had to sneak in through Mexico, and of course, you couldn't, you know, admit that you had been there. And to see what's going on today is just amazing. And to watch that press conference was amazing. How some of these Republicans, you know, the Marco Rubios and the Ted Cruz of the world who wanted to put the toothpaste back in the tube on Cuba. It's just impossible. The genie's out of the bottle on this one. And I think that your the picture of Air Force One coming in over Havana with the old, cars. I mean, just an amazing moment for President Obama, I think, and history's changed forever. And I think Raul Castro got the message today too.
Yeah, Obama was not going to be used in the process, and he was clear about that.
But you think it's a legacy?
And I think when you know, sort of add all of Obama's accomplishments, whether you like him or not, we forget that from 08 to 10, Obama was on the verge of outpacing both FDR and LBJ in terms of new legislation. And then the Tea Party backlash happened as a consequence. So we forget that part. And then it stopped in its track, and he lost control, of course, Nancy Pelosi, et cetera. So I think you have to at least, you know, put that in play and understand that Barack Obama was, you know, very aggressive president domestically.
Yeah.
But this Cuba accomplishment is something that will last going forward if he can persuade Congress to actually lift the embargo through this action, kind of like Nixon going to China. In the long run, put it this way, when you look at Americans in terms of presidential greatness, you can go online and there's 1,000 different surveys. Generally, they show a pattern of FDR is usually number two or three behind Washington and maybe Jefferson, Lincoln. Actually, I'm sorry, let me correct myself. Lincoln's always first mm-hmm. on everybody's survey. Washington's about second or third interchangeably regularly with FDR, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, Obama has put himself in terms of accomplishments, both domestically and in foreign policy, like it or not. Like you hear Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, and it's depressing because they're lying to the public when they say, well, this Iran deal, they gave millions of dollars to the Iranians. And what they've done is just unfroze, if I'm not mistaken, the Iranians' money and given right. the Iranians their own money right. that was being held. So it's just, it's misrepresenting the truth. Like your tax dollars are going to Tehran. It's a you know, total misrepresentation. Yeah. And so I think, you know, this kind of thing is a real problem.
He gets a chance to really make a statement himself.
Yeah, and, mm-hmm. I think we should note, you know, Bay Area has had some real representation here. Barbara Lee has been one of the leaders on this in terms of she's been to Cuba a dozens of times. She helped open flight mm-hmm. paths and so forth. Mm-hmm. And now today, Senator Feinstein and Senator Boxer both talking about the need for direct flights from Cuba. So I think we're going to see some changes here, as you mentioned. I mean, really...
Okay.
Yeah. Let me just wrap it up real quick. Sure. And just to say that, again, FDR is one of the few presidents who's had both foreign policy and domestic success. You look yeah. at George Bush, the father, he wins the war in Iraq in February 1991. He's out of office right. 1990. He comes back February 1992. He's out of office by November 92.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, you have to sort of keep in play, keep an awareness that there are these sort of electoral rewards and electoral punishments. And the electorate, again, I have faith in the electorate that its wisdom will emerge.
Everyone in the room and everyone watching, he trusts you.
Well, California voters are proving themselves together. Because when 2010 happened, when everyone was talking about the Tea Party sure. backlash in national elections, California won, and I don't think the Republicans, and I don't mean to offend any Republican here, but I don't think any Republicans won a single district in 2010 in California, if I'm not mistaken, when the Republicans had a great deal to party about
right.
in November 2010. So California's been consistent.
On that note, we're going to our news quiz, folks. If Fran could come up, Fran's going to be our prize distributor today. I'm going to ask some questions. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. Don't just shout it out. Raise your hand, and I'll call on you, and if you get it right, you get a delivery from Fran.
I learned a lot.
Thank you, Fran. Okay. First question. How is the National Football League planning to react if Georgia passes a law that exempts religious people from anti-discrimination laws? Saw your hand first. That's right. They will exclude Atlanta from that list.
Good job, good job.
You're just saying that because you're 49ers fans.
That's the one group Trump has not offended, if you notice, is gays. No, think about that. Trump has not offended. He's offended everybody else as much as he could, but he's not offended any particular gay group. Have you noticed that?
Has he taken any stands on...
I don't know what his positions and his policy positions are, but I'm just saying, his off-the-cuff style,
yeah.
that's the one group he has not offended. And I think if he did, that would be the unacceptable discrimination that would backfire on him. I'm thinking.
Warms your heart now about Trump. You're reconsidering.
That's right. I'll make a point, baby. I'll call you the next day after the election.
Okay, well, on that line then, Donald Trump got the endorsement from what former star of the TV series Happy Days, Ma'am? Sorry? No. Nope. A star of Happy Days, sir? Scott Baio played Chachi.
Yeah.
But you're right. Palin had endorsed him before. She's a different type of TV star, though. It was reported this weekend that Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, she does not have enough votes to prevent what? Sir. Sorry?
Impeachment.
That's right. She's facing impeachment on corruption charges. Last week, 62 people died in a plane crash where?
Russia.
Sir? That's right. Russia. Who successfully sued Gawker.com for $115 million?
Sir?
Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan, that's right. Okay, a few more. Well, I mentioned that President Obama is in Cuba this week. Who was the last U.S. president to visit Cuba? I'm going to have to go with you, sir.
Coolidge.
Calvin Coolidge, Silent Cal.
Silent Cal.
Still there, I think. Okay. An American buyer paid $20,655 to purchase Adolf Hitler's personal copy of what? So I need a hand, sir? Mein Kampf, that's right. Do you see the hand? Okay. Okay, and... Oh, okay, so this is a little bit longer one, but I think it's worth it. These are actual interview questions asked by a local company. They're no longer used. Such as, how much should you charge to wash all the windows in Seattle? Or, a man pushed his car to a hotel and lost his fortune. What happened? Or, what is the probability of breaking a stick into three pieces and forming a triangle? Who asked these questions in job interviews? Ma'am?
I'm going to guess. Google?
You're right. Google.
Good.
That was good. That was good.
Okay, two more here. The computer gaming industry has been rocked in recent years by incidents of virulent sexism, intimidation, and threats. Why did Microsoft apologize this week? Did you see this story? Sir?
Oh, yeah, they had strippers down in the South of Market.
That's right. They hired female go-go dancers for a gaming conference it held. This is the same company that you might recall their CEO.
The female backlash in 2016 is going to be fierce.
Yeah.
Fierce.
Their CEO said that women should not demand pay increases. It's actually better if they just waited quietly for them.
The woman backlash is going to be fierce.
And they're going to be using apples. Okay, so final question. Who gained 1 million Instagram followers within 24 hours? Ma'am. Sorry? Pope Francis, that is correct.
Yes.
Well, we'll have more news quiz questions, and of course, much more to discuss on Monday, April 4th, back here in San Francisco. You can find our week-to-week news quiz every Friday on Huffington Post. Thanks to our panel, Dr. James Taylor, Carla Marinucci, and Daniel Bornstein. Thanks to all of you here, everyone listening and watching online. Have a great week. We'll see you next time.
Great. Good job.